This is the text for making audiobook in MP3 of They Walked Among Us, by Louis Harris. Chapter 1. My dying father makes a pact. Early one morning in 1909 I woke with a strange feeling of excitement. It was almost exhilaration as I recalled my visit, with my father the previous night, to the Palace Theatre in Porth, S. Wales. Strangely, it was not so much the stage performance which enchanted me, but the accompanying orchestra which filled my childish heart with such delight. The thrill of it still lingered when I woke the following morning. I could picture Tommy Morris, the conductor, expertly leading his musicians as he swayed, caressing his violin with his chin while his sensitive fingers coaxed one lovely melody after another from his precious instrument. Something stirred deep down inside me. I knew when I grew up I wanted to be a violinist. I, too, would make the strings sing sweet music. I, too, might lead a similar orchestra. The decision was surprising. I was only 9 years old and had never played any instrument. Nevertheless, I knew that was what I would one day be. At that time I could not possibly know what destiny held in store for me, how fate had already decreed that my path should cross that of Alexander Frederick Harris, of Cardiff, S. Wales. Though then totally unaware of his extraordinary psychic powers, he was destined, it seemed, to become one of the most outstanding materialization mediums of our time. This is our story, that of our meeting, marriage and eventual mutual involvement in developing his quite phenomenal spirit gifts. Alex's dedication and his selfless service to the sick and the bereaved are well known. Countless spiritualists and non-spiritualists flocked to our home to witness and marvel, because when Alex sat in the seance cabinet, the two worlds, apparently so far apart and inaccessible to one another, couldn't did meet. The spirit world manifestations were as solid and real as physical ones. On that morning after my theater visit, I had a mind only for music, indeed, only for the violin. Eventually, when aged 15 and a half, I became a qualified violinist. My dream came true. It was then 1916. Britain was in the throes of war. Quite unexpectedly, father's health gave the family cause for grave concern. He contracted an incurable ailment and became seriously ill. Very soon he had to give up his job. Father ultimately succumbed to the malignant disease and passed on. It was a bitter blow to all of us. He had always made home such a happy place, filling it with musicians and singers, and a message he sent to me through mother, that set me thinking about life after death. The subsequent fulfillment of a prophecy proved beyond doubt that he lived on. It was the first link in a chain of psychic events which indicated that this world and the beyond interpenetrate. Each is as real as the other. None of us in the family had had any psychic experiences, except father, who often spoke of hearing voices. Not being conversant with such matters, we were inclined to treat these disembodied voices with a measure of jocularity, as a figment of imagination perhaps. But father's awareness of the hereafter was greater than we realized. On the morning of his passing, as he lay on his deathbed weak and unable to move, he whispered to my mother. "I have to leave you now," he said. "Sorry I can't see my boy, Ted, before I go, and my little Lou." His voice was so quiet mother had to lean close to his mouth to hear him. Ted was still serving in France. Then came the message for me, barely audible. Tell little Lou that I'll be the first to greet her from the other side." Mother nodded, too overcome to speak. Father was quiet for some time. His eyes were closed. Then, quite unexpectedly, he sat up unaided, his eyes open, his face radiant. He stretched out his arms and joyfully exclaimed, "George! Austin!" These were the names of his dead brothers. A beautiful smile transformed his thin face. With a deep sigh of satisfaction he lay back on his pillows and passed peacefully to the spirit world. Father kept his word and made himself known to me at a sitting some years later. Even before that I often heard his voice calling my name. After father's death, mother left her home in the Rhondda Valley and came to live with me in Waterloo, a suburb of Liverpool. My experience of orchestras began to grow as I applied for, and got, a variety of violinist engagements. But, In 1909, Mother began to yearn for the Rhondda Valley with all its old associations, and said she wanted to return. I decided to give up my job and go with her. Once back in our home territory, I sought, and obtained, the job of violin lead at the Hippodrome, Tony Pandy. Once more we were financially secure. The Hippodrome engagement had far-reaching consequences for me, and might be considered the turning point in my life. It was there I became friendly with the pianist Peggy Gunter, later to become Mrs. Phillips and, as such, the aunt of Alec Harris, the man I was destined to marry. Peggy and I were very close friends. Unfortunately, we had to leave the Empire, where we later worked, when a dispute erupted. The union called us out on strike. Peggy and I found ourselves without employment. After we kicked our heels in frustration for a time, Peggy suddenly came up with a suggestion. How about attending an audition for that summer job that's going at Ilfracombe? If we don't get it, it would be nice to go there just for the day. The idea appealed to me. So, the following Saturday, two excited young ladies caught the early boat from Cardiff bound for Devon. We attended the audition, which was successful, but declined the job because of the poor remuneration offered. Feeling that nothing was lost as we had had a lovely day, we boarded the boat to return to Cardiff. And this is where fate took a hand in shaping my future. A thick, black cloud descended on our boat. This worsened until it became a generalized fog, making visibility practically nil. As a result, our arrival in Cardiff was delayed 3 hours. To our dismay, we missed our train connection and could not get home. I suggested to Peggy that we spend the night with a friend of mine, Lily Bristow. I knew she would gladly help us out of our dilemma. So, within an hour, two weary, dejected girls were knocking at her door, pouring out their tale of woe. Lily was understanding and gladly offered us shelter for the night. The next day was Sunday. It is one I shall always regard as my special day, for that was when I saw Alec Harris for the first time. Peggy woke me early. I was surprised, as it was only 6:30 a.m., to see she was already dressed. "Lou, I've just thought," she said, "I can't go home without first seeing my husband's sister and brother-in-law and their children." "Oh," I said, still half asleep, "where are they?" "They live in Malifont Street. You've heard me speak of Fred and Edith Harris, surely? She's my husband's sister. Would you like to come along with me? I'd like you to meet them." "But Malifont Street is a long way from here," I said. "Remember, it is Sunday. There's no transport." "Never mind," said Peggy. "We can walk there." She was insistent. "When do you want to go?" I asked. "Right now," said Peggy. "Now?" I gasped. "But it's only 6:30. You can't visit people at this time of the morning." "The Harrises aren't just people, they're family," exclaimed Peggy. "Anyway, if we've got to walk, and you have still to dress, we won't get there much before 8. I dressed hurriedly and we set off in the direction of Malifont Street. After what seemed like ages, with my violin case feeling more cumbersome every step, we arrived. We stood in front of a long terrace of houses. There seemed to be nothing to distinguish number 123 from any of the others. We went through the gate, up the path, and knocked on the door. There was no answer. "Like I thought," said Peggy. "They're still asleep." She tried the door, and found it latched. Peggy knocked. I held back nervously as we waited. Presently footsteps could be heard. The door was opened by a beautiful girl, no more than 16. She was still in her night attire. Her light, brown hair curled softly around a face that could not conceal its surprise at being confronted by visitors so early on a Sunday morning. Her eyes lit up with pleasure as she recognized Peggy. "It's you, Aunt Peggy," she smiled. "I'm afraid we are all still in bed. Come in and I'll go and call everyone." Peggy kissed her and then turned to me. "This is Connie Harris, one of the 7 children I told you about," she said. Connie excused herself and started up the stairs. Peggy closed the door behind me. I followed her into the Harrises' sitting room. Suddenly an idea struck her. She said, her eyes narrowed and twinkling with mischief, "Let's wake 'em all up, give 'em a surprise." "How?" I whispered, fearful that they might hear. I'll even show you, said Peggy. She walked over to the corner of the room, opened the piano, sat down, and started to play a rousing march, thumping the keys with all her might. Catching Peggy's mood, I grabbed my violin and gleefully added my talents to the cacophony. It had the desired effect. Soon, there was a thumping overhead as people fell out of bed. Voices were raised, calling to one another, "What's going on? Who's that? Downstairs? Who's making that racket at this hour of the morning?" Then came the resonant baritone voice of Alec's father, Fred. "Has everyone gone mad in this house?" he asked. "It's only 8 o'clock. And it's Sunday." Within minutes the Harrises were streaming downstairs into the living room. The last to come in, still pulling on a pair of trousers over his striped pajamas, was a sturdy, well-built young man of 24, about 5 feet 8 inches tall. He stopped dead in his tracks as he caught sight of me. I ceased playing in the middle of a bar, bow in hand, violin still tucked under my chin, mouth gaping like a goldfish. I couldn't move. I felt that a hand had grabbed my heart, and the fingers were squeezing so tight that I couldn't breathe. For what seemed a very long moment we stood still and stared at one another. Peggy broke the spell when she asked Fred and Alec's mother, Edith, to forgive our practical joke. Peggy presented me to each member of the family, finally saying, "This charming young lad who seems transfixed in the doorway is Alexander Harris. We all call him Alec." We smiled at each other awkwardly, he suddenly aware of his state of undress, realizing it was too late to do anything about it. I was conscious, for the second time in my life, of a stirring deep inside me. It was a feeling I could not comprehend, yet somehow I knew it was concerned with my meeting Alec. This encounter was later to weld our lives together in a lifelong partnership of love and service to those in two worlds. Chapter 2 We get married. Alec Harris' path and mine did not cross again for 2 years. In 1923, Mother and I moved from the Rhondda Valley to Cardiff. Alec later explained that though we did not meet, he frequently stood on the opposite corner of the street outside the theatre where I worked and watched me being escorted home by the same man every evening. Naturally, he assumed we were going steady and made no approaches. The escort in question happened to be a fellow musician who, because he was going my way, offered to see me home safely each night at that late hour. It was an act of courtesy, nothing more, and I regret that it kept me apart from Alec. Finally, we met again one cold December night as we were both taking our respective mothers home after a show. The four of us were on the same tram, but unaware of each other. Mother nudged me, and whispered in my ear, "Look at that boy sitting over there. He looks just like Theophilus, Peggy's husband." Peggy had married Theophilus Phillips, Alec's mother's brother. It was no wonder there was a family resemblance. "That's the Harris boy I was telling you about," I whispered, excited at seeing him again. When the tram stopped, I saw that Alec and his mother had also alighted. My heart gave a little somersault as I realized he was coming over to speak to us. "Good evening, Miss Bradley," came the soft, rich baritone voice. "Nice to meet you again." The Welsh lilt made music of his speech. "Oh, hello," I said, shyly. "Good evening, Mrs. Harris." "We haven't seen you in years," she replied. "Two," I said, and hastily bit my lip. It sounded as if I had been counting them, which, of course, I had. "This is my mother," I said, quickly, to cover up. Our mothers went on ahead, chatting amiably, while Alec and I walked behind, shyly making small talk. We were awkward, very conscious of one another. When we parted company, Mrs. Harris remarked, "We're having a party on Christmas Day. Why don't you and your daughter come along? We'd love to have you." "That's a good idea," said Alec. "We always have a lot of fun. You'll meet a lot of nice people." Before Mother could reply, I interrupted, saying, "I'm afraid I can't. Thank you very much though, it's nice of you to ask us." I glanced quickly at Alec to see his reaction. I was gratified that he looked crestfallen. "I'm going to a theatre party on Christmas Day," I explained. "Well then," replied Mrs. Harris undaunted, "what about Christmas Eve? Alec looked anxiously at me. "Yes, I'm free on Christmas Eve," I said. "Very well. We will have our party on Christmas Eve." Mother and I offered profuse thanks, bade them good night and went our way. "What nice people," said Mother. I didn't answer. I was already counting the days to Christmas Eve. That first party at the Harrises' home is one I shall always remember. The music, the singing, the games, the dancing. There was so much laughter and fun. Most of all I recall it was during that evening something deep, warm, and lasting was born between Alec and me. He had unwound sufficiently to talk about himself a little. He told me he was born in Treherbert, in the Rhondda Valley, in 1897. I mentally made a note that he was 3 years older than I. Just right, I thought. Alec spoke of how, at the age of three, his family moved to Cardiff. He left school at 14 to take up a job. By way of explanation, he said, "I wanted to help contribute to the family's upkeep. For a while I worked in the office of a paint firm down at the docks." Alec smiled in reminiscence. "It made me feel very important, being a working man. Then I was offered the job as projectionist at the Gaiety Cinema. That must have been fun," I enthused. "Yes, I could see all the films for nothing," he laughed. "I liked the work there. Being good with my hands, I could keep everything in order." I nodded, but kept silent for fear of interrupting his story. "Then, when I was a lot more experienced, I got what you might call promotion." Alec emphasized the word, and smiled. "I obtained another job as projectionist and later became manager of a small cinema. Good for my ego, it was." I laughed with him. "And the war?" I asked. "Were you called up?" "Yes," he said. "I joined the Royal Engineers, and quick as a wink was over in France. I had my 18th birthday over there. 4 long years I was there, terrible years." "Tell me about them," I said. Alec shook his head. "Best to forget about them," he added. "I was one of the lucky ones." His eyes clouded. "I was in those terrible battles of the Somme and Pas Kenda. A lot of the fellows, my friends and comrades, didn't make it. I did." He sighed and shrugged his shoulders. "I had some narrow escapes, but I'm here to tell the tale. Just lucky, that's all." Alec smiled suddenly and changed the subject. "I don't want to bore you any longer," he said. "This is a party. You're looking sad." "Oh, I'm not bored," I said hastily, and added shyly, "Alec, I'm glad you made it." Our eyes locked for a moment. Without speaking, he took my arm and led me back to join the dancing inside. We met frequently after that. One Sunday afternoon Alec took me to Rowth Park, Cardiff, where there was a pretty lake. One could hire rowing boats and spend a lazy afternoon on the water. We decided to do that. After rowing about for a while, Alec pulled into the bank and rested on his oars. He looked at me, seriously. I had that breathless feeling again, but tried my level best to look calm and collected. A voice inside me said, "This is it." Slowly he leaned forward. "I love you, Lou," said Alec simply. "I've known for a long time. I want to marry you." He paused, assessing my reaction. "Well, what do you say? Will you?" Panic seized me. "I can't," I said. "I promised my father I would look after Mother. I can't marry anyone, not for years." He looked bewildered, and very disappointed. "But why ever not?" "Because, well, it's my music. It's my career. I can't give it up to marry." "But you won't have to, Louis. You can be married and still have your music. You won't have to stop." I felt I was being squeezed into a corner. I had to get out before I weakened. "Well, you see it's, I began lamely. Alec's face clouded. "Oh," he said, crestfallen. "I understand. You don't love me?" "Oh, but I do, Alec, I do. I bit my lip. The words had slipped out before I could stop them. I saw Alec's shoulders relax. "What's your answer then?" he asked softly. "Is it yes? No." I had to fight hard not to weaken. "I can't." He laughed, and his blue eyes twinkled with mischief. "Oh, it's still no, is it? Well then, and he shifted his weight suddenly, tilting the boat violently. "It's into the lake you go, my girl." He gave me a playful shove. I screamed, struggling, and fell against him. Alex's strong arms were about me. Then, slowly, he bent his head and kissed me gently. "Say yes, Lou," he whispered. "Please." I was silent, thinking hard. My musical career meant much to me. I had worked hard to achieve it. "Give me a year to think about it, Alec," I pleaded. "A year?" He gave me a twisted smile. "That's a long time when you're in love," he said wistfully. "If you are in love, you won't mind waiting," I teased, "will you?" He squeezed my hand. "No, I'll wait until you're good and ready, no matter how long." He looked very serious. "That's how much I love you, Lou." Alec sighed in resignation, picked up his oars, and said, "It's getting late. We'd best be making tracks for home." And, in silence, he began to row. 4 years passed after that afternoon on the lake before we finally decided to name the date of our wedding. It was to be a quiet family affair. So, when we emerged as man and wife, one fine day in June, 1928, we were greatly surprised to see Lionel Forkman, the well-known conductor and radio personality, and 16 members of his orchestra, grouped together at the church door, forming an archway with their instruments. I was the 17th member of that orchestra, the only woman. I was now 28 years old, Alec was 31. A wonderful new life of love, work and service together lay ahead. We soon managed to buy a house in Manaway, Whitchurch, and settled down to marital contentment. On November 1, 1932, our home was blessed by a happy event. A baby son was born to us. Inspired by my maiden name, we called him Bradley. We felt that our cup of happiness was filled to overflowing. We spent 25 exciting, eventful, happy years in Manaway. Many wondrous things were shown, and explained to us, by spirit friends. Chapter 3, Our Quest Begins. In 1934 a dreadful thing happened. My sister, May, told us that our brother, Ted, had not only become a spiritualist, but was also a medium. We were all greatly shocked. There were gasps of dismay all round. "That's nonsense, May," exclaimed Mother, looking worried. "Ted doesn't know anything about spiritualism." "He does," said May, her voice hushed as if she feared someone might hear. "He's preaching in the spiritualist church and describing dead people. Don't be silly." I laughed. "Dead? Preaching? He doesn't know his Bible well enough." "But it's not dead that's doing the preaching," added May. "Someone speaks through him, someone," her voice dropped to a shocked whisper, "who's dead?" "Dead?" We all gasped, and fell silent as we contemplated the terrible fate which had overtaken Ted. I was the first to recover. "There's only one thing to do," I said. "I'll go down, see Ted, and put a stop to all this nonsense." Soon I was confronting Ted in his small Rhondda Valley home. Pulling my petite frame up to its full height, I shook an admonitory finger at him. "Look here, Ted," I scolded, "what's all this about you being a spiritualist medium? We are all good Baptists. Shame on you. 25. My brother smiled tolerantly at the ferocious little figure in front of him. "Thank goodness," I breathed. "You still look all right. But why, Ted, why?" I asked. "You've always been such a sensible person." "I still am," he laughed. "And so are you." "Me? What's that got to do with it?" I snapped. "Just that you, too, will be in the movement very soon." "Me?" I was flabbergasted. "No. Alec would never agree to it. He's coming into it, too, but he doesn't know it yet." Ted was positively beaming. "Shall I tell you something else? You will both do far greater work together than I could ever hope to do. It's something special." "Nonsense," I retorted. "That's ridiculous, Ted. How can you say a thing like that? It's not me. I'm not saying it. It's Michael." "Michael?" I inquired, looking around me, seeing no one. "Who's Michael?" "He's a spirit guide," said Ted. "He has never been wrong yet." I felt bewildered, distrustful of Ted's words. Nevertheless, I experienced a vague stirring of interest. It prompted me to put many questions to him about spiritualism, often arguing volubly. Ted answered tolerantly, patiently. I asked how he became interested in the subject. He chuckled, as if at some private joke. I pressed him further for an answer. Still smiling at the memory of it, Ted told how he noticed that his wife, Annie, and a friend, always went out on a Monday evening. They never said where they were going and seemed rather secretive about this regular outing. He decided that, on the next Monday's excursion, he would follow them. Keeping well out of sight, Ted saw them enter a house which was unknown to him. The door was open. Several others walked in without any preliminary knock or invitation. Ted followed them, and found himself in a large room. It had a row of seats and a platform at one end. It's a meeting, thought Ted. He seated himself at the back of the room, well concealed from his wife's vision and that of her friend, who were sitting at the front. A man stepped onto the platform. He started to address several of those present, giving them messages from departed friends or loved ones. Understanding dawned on Ted. This had something to do with what was called spiritualism, a subject one usually spoke of in hushed tones. Not wishing to have any part of this, Ted slid down as far as possible in his seat to make himself less conspicuous. Alas, his movement attracted the attention of the man on the platform, who promptly, to Ted's dismay, stepped down, and walked straight towards him. All eyes turned in his direction. "You, sir," began the man, pointing a finger at Ted, who squirmed uneasily. "There is a young Frenchman here, a soldier, named Pierre. He says you served together in the war, working with horses, lorries, transport. Do you know this man?" Ted disliked the attention he was attracting, fearing that Annie would discover his presence. He kept his voice low. 27. "I met many people called Pierre in France. How am I to know which one this is?" Ted was being difficult, trying to trip the medium who, nevertheless, continued undaunted. "This Pierre is now showing me a scene," he said. "You are both standing under some trees alongside your lorries. It is a battlefield. There is a bridge. Pierre is saying, 'You stay here, I will go over first.' He leaves you to cross the bridge. As he does so, there is a great explosion. The bridge is blown up. Pierre is killed." Ted was astounded. He recalled the incident very well, and remembered his friend. He was further taken aback when the medium remarked that Ted, too, could contact the dead and bring messages of hope to the living. "I suggest you join a circle and develop this gift," the medium urged. This conversation was overheard by Annie. Needless to say, she was delighted. "Annie persuaded me to form our own circle," smiled Ted. "After only 3 sittings, I was controlled by my spirit guide, Michael. That's how it happened. There was nothing I could do about it. But now I'm glad, Lou, very glad. It has changed my life." I asked him if he had seen Dad. He replied, "No. I haven't seen him, but he has been described to me." Ted paused, as if listening, and continued, "Michael is saying you will see Dad before I do. Lovely thought, isn't it?" Somewhat shamefaced, I took my leave, begging him not to mention the subject to Alec and Mother when he came to see us. "Alec is sure to object," I said. "It will only cause trouble." Ted did not take umbrage at my rudeness. He merely put an arm about my shoulders, and smiled. "Don't worry," he promised. "I will hold my tongue. But mark my words, Michael is never wrong. I did not discuss this conversation with anyone, least of all Alec." So he was quite unprepared for what happened 2 months later. Alec had to make a business call on a Mr. Hewitt, whose house was across the road from us. Finding he was not yet back from work, Alec fell into conversation with his wife, Mary. A chance remark she made, apropos of nothing they were discussing, caused Alec to beat a hasty retreat. According to Alec, Mary seemed to look through him, rather than at him, as she remarked, "You have a lot of lights around you, Mr. Harris. Do you know you are a very powerful medium?" Alec stammered, "What kind of a medium do you mean?" Mary replied, "Why, a spiritualist medium, of course.